Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Health and Wellness Podcast brought to you by the experts at Sanford Health. I'm your host, Simon Floss with Sanford Health News. Today we are talking about an issue that everybody faces at some point in their lives, sleep or lack of sleep. Here to help us drift through dreamland is Dr. Haven Mollish, a pulmonologist and sleep medicine specialist at Sanford Health in Bismarck, North Dakota. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So first things first, what are a few sleep stats that you can share with us?
Probably the most common sleep issue is insomnia, and I'd say at least half of the population experiences that at some point. More common in older age, but it can affect any age of patients. And another common one is obstructive sleep apnea. That's probably one of the most common organic sleep disorders. About 20% of the population is estimated to have that. So there's a lot of patients out there that are still undiagnosed, but there's been quite some headway in terms of getting people diagnosed and treated over the last 20 years. Even 40 years ago, we had hardly ever heard of this condition. So a lot of progress has been made and a lot more can be done though.
And what might be some signs of poor sleep?
So I'd say, sleep deprivation kind of hits on that. And I think it's kind of rampant that the average person only gets 6 to 7 hours of sleep per night. And what's recommended is 7 to 8. When you have poor sleep or essentially a sleep deprived state, it's either not enough sleep or the sleep quality is not as good as it should be, even if you're getting that 7 to 8 hours of sleep. If you have either of those, you're going to present with signs of sleep deprivation or of impairment in some way. And so that can be poor cognition, difficulty thinking, difficulty even with executive function. It can affect your mood. Your partner might say you're more irritable, difficulty staying on task. And one of the most common public health issues is like sleepy driving, especially truck drivers not getting enough sleep or with undiagnosed sleep apnea. There's a safety concern there. And so that all, what applies to truck drivers also applies to the general population. You're going to have difficulty with motor tasks, falling asleep during normal daily activities and so forth.
So from a health standpoint, and I know you mentioned side effects people can expect day to day if they're not getting enough sleep, but what happens health-wise or physically if someone doesn't get enough sleep? I've heard things like weight gain, a lower immune system. So what are some risk factors physically if someone isn't getting enough sleep?
And that's a really good question, and that's a really good distinction to make, because the patient's not going to say, come present and say, hi, my immune system's weak because I'm sleep deprived. They're going to come in with the primary, the immediate effects of the sleep, the poor sleep or sleep deprivation type of situation. So the actual health effects are going to be, like you said, poor immune response. Even when I was, I did my undergraduate at University of Pennsylvania, and there were always these studies you could sign up for as a student, and they, it would essentially be staying up for 3 days or, maybe 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night over a 3-day period, something like that. And then they would do blood draws and see what your immune, how robust your immune system was. And I think the results were that you definitely have a weakened immune system with sleep deprivation. You also have a pro-inflammatory response. So your cytokines go up, your interleukins go up. Things that promote inflammation, the markers that promote inflammation are all elevated. If you're sleep deprived, you've got increased risk of hypertension. So it's got cardiovascular effects, which can then lead to increased risk of, stroke and heart attack. In regards to the hormone changes, you have the hormones that promote weight gain, or the balance of hormones will promote weight gain. So with sleep deprivation, you have increase in the hormone ghrelin, which makes you more hungry. And then you have a decrease in leptin. Leptin's supposed to suppress your appetite. And so you've got the hunger hormone increased and the appetite suppression hormone decrease. And so that just makes you want to eat a donut instead of celery, so you're craving things that aren't necessarily good for you. That tends to be what you're predisposed to eat poorly with sleep deprivation. There's various other health risks as well. So it's the bottom line is that it affects a broad sleep deprivation or poor quality sleep affects a broad array of systems within the body that can adversely affect your health.
So, doctor, what should good sleep look like then? And I know you mentioned it earlier, but how much sleep does a person really need? You know, some people say, oh, I really only need 4 to 5 hours and I feel great. But as we've talked about here today, that's really not the case.
Essentially, this broaches on the topic of good sleep hygiene. And the framework is going to bed, trying to go to bed at the same time every night. And even more importantly, getting up at the same time every morning, because really getting up the same time every morning really kind of sets your clock for the whole day. And so, for example, if you go to bed too late, you're going to want to wake up later. But if you're waking up at the same time, then that kind of sets things in a regular pattern to where your body is used to, you know, a certain circadian rhythm. And so for most people, in terms of the actual sleep amount, 7 to 8 hours, with some rare exceptions. There was a saying when I was learning about sleep that they say scholars get 7, bankers get 8, and gluttons get 9 or more. And so that's kind of a good way to remember it. Even if you're sleep deprived, 2 nights, 10 hours, it should be sufficient to catch up in most cases. So once you get more than that, it can also have adverse health effects. More sedentary. I think it's related to being more sedentary. And so 7 to 8 hours is the target. There are some rare exceptions to that, but those are people with genetic, where they are just short sleepers. And it actually is true that there are some people rarely that can get 4 to 5 hours. They just can't sleep more than that. They don't have any other sleep conditions or underlying sleep disturbances. They feel refreshed after that, but that's the rare exception.
So what are some ways to improve your sleep then?
So it depends on what your starting point is. You know, I'd say that if people are struggling with the quality of sleep, first thing to start with is good sleep hygiene. And so that has to do in part with what we've already discussed, trying to go to bed at a certain time, getting up at a certain time, minimizing what we call stimulus control. So minimizing things that can distract you, making it a quiet place, maybe with some white background noise. If you tend to stress about not being able to fall asleep, then we say turn the clock away from you so you don't clock watch. Avoiding blue light in the evening, which can disrupt kind of your melatonin and circadian rhythm and make you want to stay up later, which might be harder to get up at the time you want to get up if you're going to bed later.
So what you're saying is no mindlessly scrolling TikToks in bed at night?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so avoid the technology. You know, the blue light feature on a lot of technology, it's a good thing in general, but if you're scrolling, even with the blue light filter on, it's the seeing things and saying, ooh, I like that, or I don't like this post, the social media post. The social media tends to activate your brain too, even if there's no blue light. And so some people more than others, people who tend to get really into their social media, I'd say just forget the devices altogether for a good 2-3 hours prior to bedtime. But the blue light's another factor. So watching TV with blue light, for example, it doesn't have the social media component, but then the blue light from it can be disruptive as well.
So if you're struggling to get good sleep and you're noticing things just aren't improving, could it be a sleep disorder? When does that come into play and when might that be a factor?
One of the most common presentations that I've seen is when there's a change, you know, where people are used to getting a certain amount of sleep or a certain being refreshed to a certain amount from their sleep. And then they notice things start to kind of go downhill where the sleep isn't as refreshing or the sleep is good, but they're just not able to get as much sleep. Could be from medical illness that's developing, like thyroid condition, a new medication they're on, a change in work schedule. So it can be for a variety of different reasons. But when that's the case, when the patient perceives a problem, they can always start by asking their primary care provider to guide them through the initial part of that. And then if they deem necessary, get a referral to a sleep specialist. And so if it's not one of those first issues, then we look for a primary sleep disturbance, most common of which is, or one of the most common ones is obstructive sleep apnea. Like I said, 20% 90% of the population has it, can present even in children, but, you know, it's also associated with older age because it, you know, as we age, we tend to gain weight, and weight gain's associated with sleep apnea. It's not the only risk factor, but it's one of them. So if there's a problem with the sleep, I'd say go to your primary care doctor first. Make sure you're doing all the good sleep hygiene techniques that we've talked about. And then if it's still an issue, then you might need to see a sleep specialist.
I know melatonin and ZQIL are very popular for over-the-counter sleep aids. What are the pros and cons of over-the-counter sleep aids, and are there any long-term use effects with those?
Now, that's another good question. So I'd say I'll start with the most common over-the-counter sleep aid, and that's going to be diphenhydramine, which is an antihistamine. And it's primarily antihistamines are not intended to make people sleepy. It's one of the side effects. And so oftentimes when you see like a PM in a sleep aid, like acetaminophen with a PM or ibuprofen with a PM, oftentimes the PM is really diphenhydramine, or the common name is Benadryl. And Unisom's another antihistamine that's pretty common, but they all are in these over-the-counter sleep aids. And so there can be some benefit short-term, like if you're, you know, going on a long plane ride and you just need something to help you sleep on the plane, just one-time use, and there's not going to be a whole lot of harm in doing that. In general, when you do use these types of over-the-counter antihistamines in this fashion, you get more light sleep earlier on, but it's usually at the expense of deeper sleep later. And so it's a trade-off. Everyone's a little different. So some people know that if, as long as they're able to get to sleep initially, then if they tend to be sleepy people in general, then maybe just getting to sleep initially is their goal. But by and large, most of the people in the population, you have that trade-off where you do get better, more lighter sleep earlier in the night, but then later you're going to toss and turn a little bit more and not get that deep REM sleep that you're supposed to be getting later in the night. Now, in terms of long-term use, there is the Benadryl or diphenhydramine has been linked to dementia. And initially we thought this was reversible, but studies have shown that it's not necessarily the case. So I would not recommend any long-term use of diphenhydramine to help people sleep.
Specifically for over-the-counter medicines and sleep aids that contain diphenhydramine, what would some name brands be that contain that?
It'd be Tylenol PM, Motrin PM. Those are probably the most common ones. Unisom, it's not Benadryl, but it's another antihistamine. And so those are the most common ones, I would say. There are some, what I'd say, reasonable alternatives. And you asked about melatonin. That's something our body kind of creates anyway. And that can be a good aid to help people kind of readjust their clock, or as what we call a hypnotic, to help them fall asleep at the beginning of the night. What I've seen is that for those in those patients where it works, it usually works for an initial time period. Then a lot of times it'll lose its effect over time. But it can be very helpful, especially if you've got jet lag, but you got to time it appropriately. And it's one of, melatonin's a tricky one. It's one of those where more's not necessarily better. And if you take it too late, it could have the opposite effect. And so I'm going to circle back to Benadryl and the antihistamines, is that some people, when they take the Benadryl or things like it, they'll say that it makes them wired. And usually what I've seen in that situation is if those are people with restless leg syndrome. And so it's that the antihistamine, if you have restless legs, can make the restless legs a lot worse. And so they're just moving their legs the whole night. And so it's not that it makes you wired, it just makes the restless legs worse. And that's why the Benadryl doesn't work. So that's another, you know, if anyone's out there listening, say, well, when I take Benadryl, I'm just crawling off the walls, and you probably have restless legs. And there is treatment for that. The first one being avoid medicines that make it worse.
So just a couple more questions here before we let you get on your way. What type of care or programs does Sanford offer for sleep challenges or sleep disorders?
There are sleep specialists at most of the major locations. We do offer sleep study testing. This usually involves an overnight study where they hook a bunch of electrodes to you, to your head, around your nose. There's a EKG. It's got some limb leads on there. And so we get a lot of good information from a sleep study. And so that's usually going to be the initial first step. I know here in Bismarck, we go down to age three. We're accredited down to age three with the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. We've got a fully accredited lab. And then we also do some other like daytime testing to look for things like narcolepsy and other what we call conditions of hypersomnolence. And so we do have a pretty comprehensive sleep evaluation service here and clinicians that can follow up on those results. And I think that holds through for most of the major Sanford locations. One of the new programs that we've developed recently is one of the alternative treatments for sleep apnea. Let's start by just saying with obstructive sleep apnea, the primary treatment of it is something involving positive airway pressure or continuous positive airway pressure, which is CPAP, which a lot of people have heard of. And so about two-thirds of the time, patients can tolerate it. And within that two-thirds, a third of them love it initially, and the second third get used to it eventually, and then the final third just can't do it. And so there's an alternative that kind of moves the tongue forward in your sleep and clears the airway. And so that's a newer program. It's called the Inspire device. And so an ear, nose, throat specialist puts that in. Here it's Dr. Sharon. We've done over 100 of these here and really kind of pioneered the way here in Bismarck in terms of that therapy. I don't think anyone else is offering that within the vicinity. So if patients are struggling with CPAP, that's one of the newer programs is to get evaluated to see if the Inspire device can help. We treat the whole gamut of sleep disorders, though. Restless legs, narcolepsy, you know, even if you have insomnia, usually your primary care provider can try to help initially. But insomnia may also be an indicator of an underlying sleep disturbance. So if the initial approach with the primary care provider isn't getting the patient where they need to be, then a sleep specialist referral may be very helpful.
Well, this really has been so great, Doctor, and you've shared just a plethora of information that I think is really going to help a lot of people, including me. I'm a rather light sleeper, so I was really excited to do this podcast with you because I was like, well, I'm going to talk to a pro and I'm going to learn. And you know what? I did learn a lot today. So before I let you go here, what would be a good take-home message or what's maybe the most important bit of information that you want people to know who are going to listen and read this?
So I'd say if you're not happy with where your sleep's at, be proactive. Start with the sleep hygiene. You know, that's the regularly going to bed at a certain time, using the bed for only sleep, waking up at the same time. But don't suffer with it if you don't have to. Talk to your primary care provider, see if they can help. And if needed, sleep specialty referral. We're here to help. And then we can see what else can be done. The other thing I would say is poor sleep. A lot of people chalk it up to old age, and it's not necessarily the case. I mean, just because you're getting older doesn't mean your sleep has to be poor. So be proactive and try to get things better. If you're not happy with where your sleep's at, we're here to help.
Well, thank you so much for your time and knowledge and for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This episode is part of the Health and Wellness series by Sanford Health. For additional podcast series by Sanford Health, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, and news.sanfordhealth.org. Thanks again for listening. I'm Simon Floss.